in Romans, before we get into the text, two things that were prompted recently. First of all, the hilarity of what? Right, if it weren't so sad. The question was asked last week, how did Jesus avoid total hereditary depravity? After all, Jesus was born. So how did he avoid it? And I gave you the blank stare. Thankfully, the questioner continued to talk while I gave the blank stare. And then something definitely related popped into my head, but it's not actually the full or complete answer. All right, first the question would be, where does the soul come from? All right, that is, I said this word last week, traducian, or something like that. Okay, most Calvinists hold to the traducian view. The soul is created indirectly by God through the parents. The word comes from the Latin for the branch of a vine. And you might picture for yourself a tree, and Adam was the base of the tree, and Eve, and all the other people have branched out from Adam, which is true as far as physically. The question is about the soul, though. That's the question. The teaching is that the body and the soul are generated by father and mother. It takes a father and a mother to generate a soul, according to this doctrine. This view will explain the inheritance of original sin. Certainly, a perfect God would not create a fallen soul. The most reasonable explanation for inheritance of original sin is that it takes a mother and a father. Okay, and they generate the soul. Now, you'll notice that they are assuming to begin with original sin. Okay, there is original sin, so now they're trying to work backwards. Okay, so how do we fit in everything else to original sin? Original sin, or total hereditary depravity, which however you want to call it, is the quote-unquote holy grail for these people. Don't mess with this original sin. Everything else, whether or not it's logically or logical or not, fits in with that. So, there is original sin. Now, the soul, and right in this clause, Geisler is going against creationism. God directly creates it. See, God indirectly creates it through most Calvinists. And right here, Norman Geisler is arguing, no, God wouldn't create it. He's actually not addressing this, okay? Norman Geisler believes this. He believes this up here. But he's talking about some. We'll talk about that in a minute. So the options are this. God created it directly in the womb or not? And if he didn't, then this is what they say. No, God created it indirectly through mom and dad. Create the soul. Not only the body, but the soul also. Compare, just before we go any further, look in Zechariah chapter 12. Zechariah chapter 12, verse 1. Now, if you throw away total hereditary depravity, then this verse isn't going to give you any problems. Zechariah 12, verse 1. The burden of the word of the Lord concerning Israel. Thus declares the Lord, who stretches out the heavens, lays the foundation of the earth, and forms the spirit of man within him. Right there it says God does it. Now, you got to admit, it doesn't say directly or indirectly. Okay, he might have used an intermediary. However, the context is, God stretches out the heavens. Who did that? God did. How? Directly. Then, he lays the foundation of the earth. Who did that? God. How? Directly. In context, what's the next thing? He forms the spirit of man within him. Who did that? God did. How? Well, if you're going to be consistent, and if you don't have this total hereditary depravity to worry about, then you automatically know, oh, well, he did it directly. All right. Having said that, they're arguing that the soul is created indirectly through the parents. Now, Calvinists rightly assert that Jesus did inherit human nature. He inherited human nature. Geisler, quoting Arrhenius, God caused man, that is human nature, I haven't altered this quote at all. This is Irenaeus or Geisler quoting him. To cleave to and become one with God, every stage of life, and Christ went through all the stages of human life. That's what they say. They are right about this. This is 100% right. Now, they're playing a little bit words. It's just that Jesus didn't inherit all of the human nature. Okay? He inherited human nature. Very true. That's what the Bible teaches. But they will go on to say, he didn't inherit all of human nature. Well, what do we mean by all? And how did he not? Remember, that's the question we're asking. How did he not? But first, let's talk about what does all this stuff mean? Okay. Some Calvinists, how not, we're answering. I'm bouncing back and forth, but please follow. Jesus was not the genetic descendant of his mother, Mary, but his human nature was directly created by God in Mary's womb, ex nihilo, in order for it to be free of inherent sin damage. See, the Calvinists, some of them see, wait a minute, if he was actually connected to his mother genetically, then his mother gave him the inherited, the damage. Okay, so some Calvinists see that and they say, wait a minute, that can't be. So God created it out of nothing, which is what we would say. But they're saying that God only does this for Jesus and nobody else. All right, so this man's arguing God created for Jesus his human nature out of nothing, just like he did for Adam. Remember, he did that for Adam, so it is reasonable. That God, this man is saying that about God. Mr. Geisler, who's a moderate Calvinist, he rightly asserts, if Jesus was created ex nihilo in Mary's womb, then he is not a physical descendant of Adam, which raises the question of whether he is qualified to be redeemer of the human race. Because in order for it all to work, Jesus has to be human. That is, we admit that. So far, we're kind of with Geisler sometimes, and we're the other guy sometimes. Depends on whether or not it lines up logically with the Bible. Okay, so if Jesus was just created out of nothing, then he's not actually human. In fact, he's another kind of, he'd be more like an angel, okay? All right, so Geisler rightly asserts that. No, that's not true. Jesus wasn't, his human nature wasn't created out of nothing. No, he is genetically attached to Mary. Having said that, Geisler, remember, we're asking, how not? How not? How did Jesus avoid it? Geisler's own explanation? Well, perhaps Jesus did not inherit sin because he had no human father, and both parents are necessary to inherit depravity. Or, God could simply have intervened supernaturally to prevent Jesus from inheriting sinful nature. All right, let's go on. He'll go on to say, we inherit our body and soul and sin through our parents. Otherwise, God would have to create a sinful soul each time a new baby is conceived. Because what they will not let go of is total hereditary depravity. You cannot let go of that. And so, because total hereditary depravity is, we reason backwards. No, God couldn't create it. Okay, that makes sense if total hereditary depravity is true. So, we had to inherit it from our parents. Now, how did Jesus actually avoid it? I don't really know. That's their answer. I don't know. Okay? Charles Hodge, who was a Calvinist who died many years ago, he says, pay attention to the words. This is the devil lies in the details. To assume a nature is to assume a substance with its essential attributes and properties. I'm not going to give you time to digest all that. But it's true. He took into personal union with himself a substance or essence having the same essential properties which constitutes us men. Remember, they assert he was a human. That's what this is saying so far. But there's a key word. Anybody pick up on it yet? Okay. But he did not assume the whole of that substance or essence. He took upon him all that was necessary to constitute very man. Essential. This word up here. Essential. Essential. Okay, God created Adam with everything that was essential to be human. But then, according to their doctrine, Adam sinned and it changed his essence and it added some things that are not essential. And so Jesus became human, but only he only took on what was essential to be human, whereas all of us, according to their doctrine, had taken on what is essential, which specifically is mind, will, emotions, and body. We've taken on that and guilt and sin. Because only these are essential. Everything else is added. All right. Unless guilt and sin be essential attributes or properties of human nature, and they are not essential because God did not create them, Christ did not assume the guilt by assuming the nature. Okay, but still the question is, how? How did he avoid this? Read it with me. When it is said that we derive a sinful nature from Adam, and that guilt as well as pollution attaches to the nature of fallen men, the doctrine is that we, and all who derive that nature from Adam, are personally sinful and guilty. All this, however, is denied concerning Christ. I have read most of this book. This is him. This is the book that deals with this. And you know how much of it deals with how Jesus avoided it? That one statement. The point is, don't ask. It is not supposed to be logical. It is logical up to a certain point until it becomes illogical. And then the answer is, just don't ask about it. Remember I said that quote 2 weeks ago? Trust me, there are going to be some more quotes in chapter 7. Their holy grail is total hereditary depravity, and their method is, just don't ask about it. Okay. Now you had your... Anybody, any comment, George?
I'm trying to figure out why, if these people are willing to say God saves some, period, and not others, period, and won't tell you which, period, why they'd have an issue saying God creates a sinful soul. So that's also unfair. Who cares?
Right.
Why
and they argue about it.
Why, they do. Okay.
Oh, yeah.
And it seems like they could go down that path and they won't have lost anything from their...
No.
Yeah.
Right. What they gain out of it is that they get to say that they are of the elect.
But they don't know. They say
well,
they don't know.
They say they don't know, but give them enough rope and they'll hang them. No, that, although that's true. Give them enough. Just let them talk. Whenever you're Bible studying with somebody, let them talk. Just let them talk. And whenever you're Bible studying with yourself, just write down all your thoughts. Write them all down. Because if it's true, it'll be consistent. And if it's not, it'll show itself after time. Hey, I had an inconsistent thought. And you know what you do? Scratch it off. Okay, so when you're Bible studying with somebody else, let them talk. Keep going. Prompt them. Get it all out there on the table. And it won't be very long before, oh, here's an inconsistency and here's an inconsistency. Well, let them talk. And you get them, quote-unquote, into a metaphorical corner over here. And you know, it's they say to themselves, most of them won't say it's illogical. However, when they're talking about the other Calvinists, they'll say it's illogical. Okay? But not when they're talking about themselves, all right? And of course, you just keep on going. Of course, the other Calvinist will rightly say about that one, no, that part's illogical. You know what? They're both right. The whole system is illogical. That's why. Comments or questions here? Yeah, George? Or Fred?
Way back when you were in the first part, when you were saying about when God creates a soul, whether it's directly or indirectly?
Yeah. Go ahead.
Whether it's directly or indirectly, he still creates it.
Right, but if it's indirect, then he's not guilty of creating evil. If it's indirect, he's not guilty of creating evil. Just like when he uses the deceitful spirits in the mouths of the deceitful prophets, he allows them to go and do it. Okay? But he's not the one saying, you go tell this lie. I'm giving you the lie to go and tell them. Okay? It's their idea. They're the ones that are guilty. He only indirectly directly used them, but he indirectly allowed this to happen. So the difference is whether or not God's guilty of creating evil. Any other comments or questions? Two things when you're dealing with total hereditary depravity, we'll launch in to a discussion of free will, because free will is what is depraved? Your will. You no longer have the ability to will to do what is right. So the conversation will be in 2 weeks or 3 weeks or 5 months about our will. And total hereditary depravity is illogical, and so naturally the questions about your free will are illogical. Don't ask about them. Don't ask. We can't understand that. Another point?
Yeah, I've had people ask me, do you believe in God? I'm like, I say, yes, I believe in God. I believe that He is, and He is a rewarder of those who diligently seek Him, according to the passage there. And they say, well, what about if God created all things, and He created evil? I tell them, I say, wait a minute, what is evil? Evil is lack of good.
Mm-hmm.
So if there's good, God created good. And if people aren't going to listen to the good, then they're the ones that go to evil. God
right.
doesn't create evil, He creates good. People do evil when they don't do what's right.
Correct.
Do the other.
Yeah, and that's exactly the passage. That's what Romans is saying. What I'm going to twist, I'm going to change your word a little bit. God did not create evil. God created only good. Evil is the absence of good. And who introduced the absence of good? Man did. Which is why, therefore, just as through one man, sin entered the world. That's exactly what it's talking about. Romans 5. Okay, we'll move on. Something else. This will take a few minutes. The history of law. Multiple conversations that I've had within the last month prompt me to go through this, okay? It popped up last week. Mankind has always been under law, either specifically explicitly revealed law or generally implicitly revealed law. All right, let's go through this. Genesis 2, turn to Genesis 2. We will have a specific and explicit law in Genesis 2. Verse 16, the Lord commanded who? Specifically, Adam. And He explicitly commanded him, from any tree you eat, but not from that tree. Okay, that's in a specific and explicit law. There you go. Okay, so there's that kind of law. That's the one that God specifically says, this is for you, and here's exactly, explicitly what you need. All right, then there is the generally, implicitly revealed law. Romans chapter 2, or 1, to begin with. Verse 18, the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness, unrighteousness of men who suppress the truth and unrighteousness. Because that which is known about God is evident within them, for God made it evident to them, because He sent everybody a book that they all have to read, and He's always done that exactly that way. No, He has not given everybody a book, for since the creation of the world, His invisible attributes, His eternal power and divine nature have been clearly seen, being understood through general, implicit revelation. There is a creation that implies there is a creator. Furthermore, chapter 2, verse 12, all who have sinned without the law will also perish without the law, and all who have sinned under the law will be judged by the law. Verse 14, for when the Gentiles who do not have the law do instinctively the things of the law, these, not having a law, are a law to themselves, in that they show the work of the law written in their hearts. Their conscience, bearing witness, and their thoughts, alternately accusing or else defending them. And they will be judged, verse 16. Okay, now when it says that the Gentiles do not have the law, do they not have any law? They have some law, because it says they're going to be judged. Which law don't they have? Which, very good, the explicit, specifically revealed law, which one are we talking about? The law of Moses. That's the context. They don't have the law of Moses. Now, quickly. What's the foremost command of the law of Moses? The whole law of Moses rests on what? Love God and love your neighbor. Don't punch your neighbor in the face. When these, verse 14, who do not have the law, instinctively don't punch their neighbor in the face, you see, they've all had law. They've all had this law. Everybody knows. Whether or not it's written down for them or not, everybody knows from general revelation two things. There is a God, and He has told me not to punch anybody in the face. And when I punch somebody in the face, guess what happens? I broke the law. Now, mankind, we've only talked about specific and explicit and the general and implicit revealed law. Now, I say always There's always been one or two or both of these laws. Always. Genesis 6, Genesis 9, Genesis 11, but turn especially to Genesis 15, which is thousands of years later. A couple thousand. Genesis 15, a couple thousand years after Genesis 2 and 3 and 4. Genesis 15, Israel is going to come back out of Egypt. Well, why didn't God hurry up and get that done? You remember? Genesis 15, he talks to Abraham and he says, in verse 16, in the fourth generation they will return here, for the iniquity of the non-Jew is not yet complete. In fact, at this time there were no Jews. There was no Israel, there were no Jews, there was no law of Moses. Yet, here are some non-Jews, and they have law. There has always been a law. Sorry? You teach it.
If there is no law.
Right. This implies, which is what Paul is saying in Romans chapter 5. Now, how does this all relate to what we were talking about last week? Romans chapter 5, verse 12. Just as through one man sin entered the world, and death through sin, so that death spread to all because all sin. And here's an explanation. For, until the law, sin was in the world. But sin is not imputed where there is no law. Nevertheless, death reigned from Adam until Moses, even over those who had not sinned in the likeness and the offense of Adam, who is a type of him to come. Okay, the point here is this. First of all, some people read this and take it out of context and say, see, there was no law. That's not at all what he is saying. He's saying there was a law. They all sinned. How could they all have sinned? Well, that implies that there was a law, is his argument here. It's not the same kind of law. It's not the general, it's not the explicit and specific law that Adam had. It's different. It's general and implicit and instinctive. Even those who had not sinned in the likeness of the offense of Adam. See, God said to Adam, thou shalt not do this. And when Adam broke the law, explicitly, directly, Adam, don't you do this. When he broke the law, that's one type of law to break. There's another type of law. The law that's instinctive in all of us. God says, don't punch each other in the face. He says that how? Explicitly? No. Implicitly through general revelation. All right.
They're also making an assumption that God never spoke to the
Israelites. Right. Yes.
I mean, that's an assumption they have to make.
Right.
That God never spoke to anybody.
Right. In fact, I made an assumption there, didn't I? I made the assumption too. I was hoping nobody would point that out. Right. Only because it's... My point still stands. Because of Romans chapter 1 and 2. The point still stands. There has always been... Excellent. General and explicit... Thank you. There's always been a general and explicit law. Now, I went to Genesis 15 and said, see, they always had law. In fact, I didn't qualify it with it was general and implicit. Because I don't know. God might have gone to all of them. We don't have record of it. All we have record of is the law. Well, and also, Jonah went where? Nineveh. Elisha went to Damascus. And on and on and on. We have others. All right. Specifically, the specifically explicitly revealed law to the Jews was an addition, not an upgrade, not a substitute, and not a replacement or anything else that you can think of to the pre-existing and contemporary generally revealed implicit law. I know these are a lot of big terms. Or not they're not big, but it's complex. And it was given to the Jews only. All right. First of all, let's understand. There has always been Romans... to law. There's always been Romans 2 law. Always. There has always been and still is. We can still go outside and say, or we don't even have to go outside. You can be an invalid who cannot communicate with anybody, can't read or anything. If you can think, I am, then you have the ability to reason backwards from that. I am, something must have created me or something. Okay. That law has always been. Now, the law to the Jews, which we call the Old Testament, was given to the Jews and to the Jews only. Who was the Sabbath for? Do you remember why? Because God delivered them from Egypt. Deuteronomy chapter 12, chapter 5, verses 12 through 15. Verse 15, you shall remember that you were a slave in the land of Egypt. The Lord your God brought you out of there. Therefore, the Lord your God commanded you to observe the Sabbath. Who? What other nations did God deliver out of Egypt and give them the Sabbath? None. Who was the Sabbath for? And only for? The Jews. Only for the Jews. In 2 Kings 15, when Naaman says, Elijah, you are the God. Not you. You're the spokesman for the God of the world. And from now on, I believe that there's only one God, and he's in Jerusalem. Did the prophet then say, and now you need to become a Jew? No. Right, because there is no commandment in the law of Moses. Hint, hint. There is no commandment in the law of Moses. All authority has been given to the Israelites, or to God, or however you want to phrase it. Go therefore into all the world and make Jews proselytes. There's no commandment. There is no commandment like that. Okay. So the law for the Jews is only given to the Jews. Okay. So we have this law right here, which is always in existence. And then there's, for example, the law to Adam that we just read. Don't eat of the tree. Abraham was told, you go and do some things, a couple things for him, right? A couple laws. And then we have this law of the Jews. Okay? It's not a substitution for this law over here. It's not a substitution for it. It's an addition to it. Right? Because while the Jews have this law, the Gentiles still have this law. And that's the only law that they have to live by. That's the only law that they can decide to become a Jew if they want to. Might be wise for them. But they don't have to. All right. Clear? Comments or questions? All right. Let me just do this real quick. Okay. The last point that we're making right now is the specifically, explicitly revealed law of Christ is also an addition to the pre-existing, just like the law of Moses. See over here? An addition? So is the law of Christ. The law of Christ is also an addition. Law of Christ. Law of Moses. Okay? And it is given to all people. Remember Matthew 28:18? All authority has been given to me. Go therefore and make disciples, teaching them to observe, baptizing them, and teaching them to observe all that I have told you. In Acts chapter 1, verse 8, stay here, you'll receive power, and then you'll be my ambassadors into all the world. You don't have that in the law of Moses. There's nothing like that in the law of Moses. Okay, in the law of Christ, there is, this law is for everybody. What does that say about the law of Moses then? It is no longer in effect. Right. So now we can take this law of Moses and scratch it out. But still, there's two laws. Remember this, there are two laws going on right now. There's the general law, which who has? Everybody that's ever been born. They open their eyes, they go, "Wah!" And they see creation. And at some time, they develop the ability to reason from that creation. Okay, and then there's the law of Christ. All right. This clear. So, native, that's his name, native, who lives in the jungle and has never heard the gospel, the law of Christ is not for him. That's not true.
He has the law of creation or whatever by nature.
Okay, first of all, let's back up. He has the generally revealed law, okay? And it says, God is, and you have broken my law. Everybody has that. Okay, but we're talking about the gospel. We're talking about the gospel. Right. Gary's getting here. If the native cares, what will he do? Acts 17.
Acts
Verse 24, the God who made the world and all things in it. Since He is Lord, He's put everybody. Remember verse 26? He made from one man every nation of mankind, including native, to live in all the face of the earth, including native, to live in the jungle, having predetermined their appointed times, including native, to live in the jungle in the Middle Ages, and the boundaries of their habitation. Native will never leave the jungle in the middle of their in the Middle Ages. That they would seek God if perhaps they might grope. You see, they have this law. It's generally revealed law, and they understand it. But how do they get the gospel? Well, they seek God. First of all, there's the idea of God, use what you are, use what you have, and what will God do? Give you more. Don't use what you have, and what won't God do? He won't give you more. Here's the native. He's never heard the gospel. Nobody's ever been around him. Well, and 2 Chronicles 16:9 says, the Lord searches throughout the earth to find those whose hearts are completely His. So he's wandering. Now, can you think? So the rest of this is, the question is, how? How does God get the gospel to him? Well, I do know that he needs a preacher. Romans chapter 10 says that. How will they hear unless they have had a preacher, right? At least somebody sent to them. The Ethiopian eunuch? Do you remember what happened to that guy? What did God do? Sent a preacher. Now, that was directly inspired by the Holy Spirit said to Philip, you go here. Now, I don't think God works that way anymore. I can't prove that for sure. But God has His ways and His means, doesn't He? PJ. The Philippian jailer. How did God get a messenger to him? The messenger had a dream. Right. Don't go there. Don't go there. Don't go there. Don't go there. Go over there. And so we concluded that somebody was calling us for help. Thyatira. Don't go to Thyatira. Don't go there. But yet, who does Paul meet? Lydia. Right. And OB. Anybody got that one? Onesimus, baby.
Oh.
That's what I might call him if we were pals. Okay. So Onesimus is owned. He's a slave. And what does he do? He runs away. And what is Paul? What happens to him while he ran away? He converts. And what does Paul write back? He writes back. Is it Philemon? Thank you. Philemon, you accept this guy. Because who knows, perhaps this is the reason he left you. God can work these. What about this native? Well, he's got some things to work with already, and then the rest of it is you just trust God. And in fact, it might be you doing your part. You go out and you do some door knocking somewhere. Or you get on an airplane and do some tree knocking, whatever the case might be. All right, we're not done here. All right, so there's the generally revealed law. Then there's the additional law to Adam, laws to Abraham. Other laws in here, I'm just including these. There's the law of Moses, and then there's the law of Christ. Remember this. This law, this generally revealed law here, will cause you in the law of Christ to search for the law of Christ. Now, you might not know it, but it will cause you to search for God, and God will bring you the law of Christ because everybody needs to hear the law of Christ. Now, this law back here, this law, the same law under the law of Moses, what would it cause you to search for?
God.
What would God bring you? The law of Moses? Himself?
Well, they were to be, the Jews were to be God, okay. God's light to the world.
Which is Romans chapter 2. All right? Romans chapter 2. Verse 17. You bear the name Jew and rely upon the law and boast in God and know His will and approve the things which are essential. Notice verse 14. The Gentiles do not have the law. They do instinctively the things of the law. Okay? So they don't have a written law, but the Jews do. So what were the Jews supposed to do with this law? Well, they approve the things that are essential, being instructed out of law, and are confident that you yourselves are a guide to the blind. Okay. And it, what does it go on to say?
Light.
A light to those who are in darkness. Who's in darkness? This guy over here, he's in darkness. So this law, this man over here, who is a believer, he says, hey, there's more to this world than I've got figured out in general revelation. He could go to this law and look at it and learn from it. He could be instructed out of the law. He could know God's thoughts. But did he have to become a Jew? No. He did. He could have said, okay, thank you for the information. I'm going to go back over here.
Use Cornelius.
Exactly. Cornelius, I long thought that, in my immaturity, that the best position to be in the world would have been Cornelius' position. Because, here's why. Could the Jews keep the law of Moses? No. Peter calls it a burden. It's a burden. Did you want to be under the law of Moses? No. But do you want to have the information contained in the law of Moses? Yes. Okay? That's where Cornelius was. Now, we understand that they, even the Jews themselves, were in darkness. They didn't really know what the whole picture was. So I used to say, I'd like to be Cornelius. That was foolish of me. Because I want to be under Christ's law, where I have the freedom from the law of Moses, but yet I have the knowledge that comes with the law of Christ. Okay? Does that make sense? Anybody? There's a lot in there, but this has been brought up multiple times to me personally and publicly, actually, last week. And it's important to understand, to get this concept down of how these laws interact with each other, and among other things, to understand that there always was a law. So we don't have to look for our guilt in somebody else's sin. Comments or questions? Somebody? Anyone? Well, there you go. All right, having said that, Romans 6. Answers. People bring answers? People want to go over the questions? We'll keep your questions out, and we're going to answer number 4. But first of all, Romans chapter 6 begins with, what shall we say then? Are we to continue in sin so that grace may increase? The end of chapter 5 in verse 20. The whole point of chapter 5, verses 12 through 21 is, Jesus is only one man, yet he can take care of our sins. And when he takes care of our sins, boy, does he ever. He can take care of any sin and all sins. Pile them on, he can take care of them. Verse 20, the second part of it, where sin increased, grace abounded all the more. That's the end summary of verses 12 through 21. Okay, so where sin increased, grace abounded the more. So the more sin there is, the more grace there is. And God wants his grace to be known, doesn't he? And so what do we conclude? Well, let me just go ahead and sin. Because the more I sin, the more God's grace can be demonstrated in the world. Is that true? Yes. Is the conclusion that we should sin true? Not at all. Which is his argument, right? He says, may it never be. Never. He'll say this expression 14 times. One person writes, Wallace writes, that it indicates repulsion at the thought that somebody might infer this. You're actually thinking that? Never think that. MacArthur writes, it contains a sense of outrage. Paul is repulsed by the idea. It's outrageous that somebody would think it. Sin is a four-letter word. We stay away from it. We just don't go there. That is not for the Christian. Paul's answer in chapter 6, the first 14 verses is going to be one thing over and over and over and over and over and over again. Never choose sin. Just don't do it. Two Saturdays ago, I think it was, we were down in Canastota. And I preached a lesson that you all have heard here. And one point, the main point of my lesson was, how is your prayer life? And I put it up there on the screen, how is your prayer life? And I left it up there, and I kept on saying that, asking that. I think 4 or 5 times I asked, how is your prayer life? How is your prayer life? How is your prayer life? And then I'd go on and make a point, and I'd come back to, how is your prayer life? Being redundant, pounding it in, pounding it in, pounding it in. Somebody came up to me afterwards and said, you know, it was a good lesson. I was listening, I was listening, you know, I was listening. But about the third or fourth time you said, how is your prayer life, I finally got. I wonder how my prayer life is. I guess it takes that many times sometimes, doesn't it? Maybe 40 times, maybe 400 times. Paul is doing exactly the same thing here. Don't ever, ever, ever choose sin. That's what he says in all of these verses. Go with me for a minute. Verse 2. May it never be, how shall we who died to sin still live in it? How? It does not compute. Logical impossibility. How? In fact, we would emphasize, in English, we would emphasize how. How? Rightly so. Interestingly, in the original, it's written differently and the emphasis is different. In the original, it's written more like the New International Version, which starts with, we are those who have died to sin. It starts with we. That's the first part of it. We. We. May we sin? May it never be. We. There is one class in this world of people that does not sin. And we're it. Oh, maybe we should just sin so grace can increase. We! No! Never. Then, verse 2, how shall we who died to sin? Verse 4, we're going to walk in newness of... You stop that. Now you live differently. Verse 5, the old self was crucified so that the body of sin might be done away with. So you're no longer slaves of sin. Verse 7, you are freed from sin. We have died with Christ. Verse 11, consider yourselves also to be dead to sin. Verse 12, do not let sin reign. Verse 13, do not go on presenting your bodies of your member, the members of your body to sin, but present yourselves to God. Verse 14, sin shall not be master over you, for you are not under law, but under grace. Don't sin. Never, ever, 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 ever choose sin. That is not an option. Okay, so you've got a little baby. When you're training up the baby, what do you instruct the child about the road? Yes. What kind of language do you use? Stay out of the road.
Strong.
Strong. Don't you ever go in that road. And if they go into the road, what do you say? Don't you ever go in the road again. That's what he's saying here. Don't go in the road. Don't sin. That is his point. Past affections affect present life. I got married. When was that? So, May 13th. May 13th, 2005. I was going to ask Gary, but I didn't want to embarrass him with the 40s answer that he'd give. So I got married. We're married. Guess what? Ever since we have been married, our life has changed. There are things... I don't go skydiving anymore. I never did. Right? You know the song? Honey, if you left me, if you weren't with me... I like that song. It's a great song. Because he said, I'd do all these things, but I'd rather be with you. Okay, but I'd do all these things if I weren't married, but I'm married. Past actions affect present life. Did you catch the tenses as you go through this? Because we were, we now. We were, we now. We were. There are past tenses, there are present tenses, there are perfect tenses, which is an action that's done in the past, which has continuous present results. There are future tenses, and all of them were because of what you did. You no longer sin. You never, ever choose sin. At baptism, understand this. It was commitment. Oh, I got saved. Yeah, and you became a slave. Don't forget that part. I got saved. We want the Savior, but let's take the sovereign and put him over there somewhere. No, we made, at your baptism, yes, you were washed from your sins, thank God, and you said at your baptism, when he says jump, I will jump. All of, never ever sin. You can't. That's no longer a choice. At baptism, all my should I sin questions were answered for me. They were all answered. Should I? If the question is should I sin, the answer was made for me January 10th, 1998. There's the answer. Well, should I sin? January 10th, 1998. Should I sin? January 10th, 1998. Right? Anybody, comment or question? Never choose sin. That is the point here. What's the next point? Maybe we'll stop. Oh, do you not know? Or do you not know? I love this. What shall we say then? Are we to continue in sin? That grace may increase, may it never be. How shall we who died to sin still live in it? Or do you not know? Okay? If they didn't know, if they did know, don't ever say a stupid thing like that again. Don't say it. By the way, well, we'll make it. If they didn't know, and now when Paul's finished, guess what? They know. Right? They will say, I will never suggest that again. Ever. I am sorry. Thank you for correcting me. Now I understand God's will better. Here's a quick question for you. What if a person obeys every ceremonial law of Christ? They Sunday they're here, they do it. They do it right. Know this, know that, this and that. They got it all down. Yet they suggest sin. What does that tell you about that person? All of this is for naught. One last passage, really quickly. Proverbs 25. Because this is what this is really talking about. Proverbs 25 and verse 28. Like a city that is broken into and without walls. Who wants to be a city broken into without walls? Anyone? No volunteers. Is a man who has no control over his spirit. Never choose sin. That's Paul's point. It's not an option for you. When you became a Christian, you said, I will never choose sin, and I will never suggest it, ever, as long as I live. Comments or questions on this part? So we'll pick up here next week and talk about question number 4. Those who have not been baptized, list everything that does not apply to them. Thank you for your work. We'll break to right on the hour.